Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. I'm Ryan Dobson, here with your host, psychologist, and best-selling author, Dr. James Dobson. Today, we're going to turn back the time a little bit and hear a classic program between my dad and the late Chuck Colson. You know, it's scary sometimes to hear predictions that occurred multiple decades ago and then look around at our culture and realize that's where we are today. And I think you'll find many of those concepts presented here in this broadcast. But I'm going to let the program speak for itself. So here now is the late Chuck Colson with my dad, Dr. James Dobson, for the first part of The Future of America on this edition of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk.
Our guest today is my good friend Chuck Colson, who is, of course, the founder of Prison Fellowship, 43,000 volunteers in Prison Fellowship now. And, of course, Prison Fellowship International is chartered in 47 countries around the world. Mr. Colson has a law degree. He served President Nixon in the White House until Watergate blew up. He's the author of many books, The Body, Kingdoms in Conflict, Loving God, and 11 more. He's now written a new book. My good friend Chuck, it is good to have you here today.
Jim, thank you very much.
Chuck, you're going 1,000 miles an hour. The Lord's really put a lot of responsibility on your back. How are you holding up?
Well, pretty well, actually. Yeah. Jim, I get a little bit tired of traveling, as you and I have talked many times. But I feel a real excitement and enthusiasm about the challenges that we face as Christians in the world today and the critical role that we play in providing the moral base for society. And I've just come back from overseas and saw the work of Prison Fellowship in Spain and even in Greece, where evangelicals are often put in jail for witnessing their faith. And we've got a great work going on inside a prison there in Scotland and Ireland, where there's finally some peace between Protestants and Catholics in that troubled land. So when I go over and see the tremendous work going on in the prisons, it just charges my batteries.
Are prisoners doing any better now than they used to? Are human rights considered more than they were when you first started Prison Fellowship?
Yes. Around the world, that is true. And not so in America. As a matter of fact, in America, we're regressing, but that's because we have the largest incarceration rate per capita. People are frustrated. They think prisons are going to solve the problems. What's going on in America is not healthy in the criminal justice system. What's going on in many countries around the world, vast improvements, and we've been much involved in this.
I'd like to invite you back to get an update on that, because that's a subject that's very dear to your heart and should be for all of us, really. Today, I want to talk to you about your new book. You've got a novel that you've written called Gideon's Torch. And this is your first novel, is it not?
Yeah, and I really, I got to tell you, you asked me what keeps me going. I had so much fun writing this because I was able to simply sit down and recreate situations, some of them reminiscent of my own experiences in the White House and in politics. It's a story of political intrigue, but with some very profound moral messages. But I had a lot of fun writing it. I would write for 12 hours a day when I was able to take a little time off to write, and then I would go downstairs to dinner and I'd say, I can't wait, Patty, to go back and finish writing because I want to see what happens to Bernie tomorrow.
Were you making it up as you went along?
No, I had the whole idea for this book. I got in maybe seemed like a moment, probably sitting reflecting for a couple of hours on what was happening to our country and whether our nation is governable without a moral base and without shared values that we all agree upon, the habits that we're going to indoctrinate into our people and inculcate into our people, whether we're going to agree on how we live. The question of how we live is, and what kind of a culture we have presupposes what kind of political system we have.
One gets the feeling while reading this book that it's sort of prophetic and coming out of our own cultural situation.
It was consciously written to be a prophetic novel, that is to show America what kind of country we would live in if we don't change course from what we are presently doing.
You and I talked about this on the telephone last summer. Shirley and I were on a short vacation,
and we
chatted about this, and you said at that time that the worst nightmare for the future of this country is that combination of leadership where there is this liberal social agenda with regard to moral values and abortion and things of that nature. But it's sort of masked by financial conservatism and political conservatism.
Well,
do I remember that correctly?
Precisely right. It is the worst nightmare. If you have a economic liberal and a social liberal, the public at least are reacting against a pretty straightforward liberal agenda. But they're also reacting against politicians who are taking advantage of them and politicians who are using their office for self-aggrandizement, for their own perks and their own power and their own prestige. The kind of thing that's going on today, people would be marching in the streets in anger and outrage 20 years ago. And today are simply accepting, well, that's the way it is. We can't change these politicians. One party's is no better than the other. And that's why you're seeing almost half the American people favoring a third-party movement. It's because they have given up on the utopians of the left and the utopians of the right who think that you can just fine-tune some program and change the way we live. And what they're really saying is these people are only trying to keep themselves in power, left or right. And the people are tired of this. And the most dangerous phenomenon would be someone who comes along as an economic conservative and says, I'm going to lower your taxes. I'm going to have less government intrusion in your lives. I'm going to keep the government out of your pocketbooks and out of your bedrooms. And we're just going to let you live the lives any way you want because that's appealing to our basest instincts.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that person would be applauded by people as opposed to someone who is a doctrinaire liberal who today runs into the well-deserved hostility of most Americans who realize that the great liberal experiment of the 60s has failed and it's got to be reversed. So it would be a wolf in sheep's clothing who would make that kind of a case. And I'm afraid there are lots of wolves in sheep's clothing parading around out
there. You know, what has always scared me is the tendency of the American people to go for a savior, for somebody they don't know very well, some new figure who sounds good and looks good, who comes in to solve all our problems. And it doesn't matter what he believes, as long as he makes a good impression and has a kind of a positive, self-confident air about him.
Well, we're desperately looking for heroes in an age when there can be no heroes because we have no more moral standards. So someone comes along who looks good and plausible and kind of falls into the middle category and doesn't threaten people very much, and all of a sudden you can put them up on a white horse. And that's a dangerous thing in America. I've always said the most dangerous thing is not communism because we see it's evil. It is another form that comes to us looking good.
I have heard you say, and in fact you referred to it a minute ago, without a moral consensus, there can be no law. Without shared beliefs, a country is ungovernable.
Yeah, I would, if I had one message that I could get across to the American people today, it would be that. And it is, of course, the central theme of Gideon's Torch. It is the fact that I try to do it in a kind of a mystery thriller format, because stories impact people in a different way than didactic teaching. Yeah. But that is the central theme. Thomas Aquinas, centuries ago, said, without a moral consensus, there can be no law. And what he meant was, if you don't have the people behind it, if the law doesn't flow out of the organic customs and habits and traditions and beliefs of the people, then it becomes repressive, and eventually the people react against a repressive law. And there are only two restraints on human behavior. I call this Colson's Law because I haven't heard anybody else say this. Only two restraints on human behavior, the internal restraint and the external restraint. And when you take away the internal restraints of conscience, of informing conscience, of moral values, of shared moral consensus, when you take that away, you have to, in order to keep order in society, have more of the external restraints. Take away conscience and moral values and polish up the bayonets. And so government is not governable in a free society unless there is that moral basis whereby people are willing to govern themselves. Self-government presupposes that people are willing to restrain their own baser instincts and govern themselves. If they're not willing to govern their own individual behavior, collectively we can't govern ourselves as a society. And that's precisely the point of Gideon's Torch. And that's where the church comes in. Because yeah. What other society in American life can bring moral authority to bear, can make a powerful apologetic defense of moral truth in society, can even argue for the existence of truth if it isn't the church?
My father said democracy is the worst form of government if the people want evil because there's no stopping them. There's absolutely no restraint on them.
Father was absolutely right, and someone else once said that in a democracy, people get the government they deserve, which ought to give us all shivers at the moment.
That's where Gideon's Torch goes.
Let me trace what happens, because it's a very, very simple process. A, there is no truth in society. Therefore, there's no way to measure what is right or wrong. Therefore, people begin to want to do whatever is right in their own eyes. They do not believe the rules were made up for them. They believe they make up the rules. That's the creed of modern American life. That's human autonomy. We make up our own rules. So what basically happens is that a socially liberal government, that is libertarian in one sense, that lets you do anything you want, any kind of individual behavior, you start having rising numbers, percentages of illegitimacy. And as you do, you increase the welfare rules. And as you do that, you have more and more crime, because we know that illegitimacy drives all the other pathologies that are destructive of our society at the moment, including crime. That's the number one predictor of crime. And so socially liberal policies cancel out economic conservatism, because socially liberal policies cost big money to the public, and therefore they cancel it out. There was an interesting study just out that is showing that the gross domestic product is not as good as we think it is. And it says, why is the GDP so high? Why is the economy so strong? And yet we feel so bad. The reason is that so much of the economy is going for prisons, welfare, and non-productive things that it isn't putting money in people's pockets. We are paying the cost of the welfare state right now. The most dangerous person to come along is somebody who's going to say, I will lower your taxes, I will make the economy stronger, I will enable you to increase your own living, and yet I won't tell you how anybody should live their lives. I'm going to let them all make their own rules for themselves. What you end up with is chaos. And when you have chaos, let me just say one other thing that is an absolute universal truism, and I hope it's burned into the memory of our listeners today, that whenever people have faced chaos and have been given a choice between liberty and order, they have chosen order.
Even at the sacrifice of freedom.
At the sacrifice of freedom. And Benjamin Franklin said, when you choose order over liberty, you will end up getting neither. And that's precisely the story of human history. And we're treading on terribly, terribly thin ice at the moment in our culture.
Chuck, you said that four or five of the elements of this book are already in realities. You wrote them before they occurred. Do you believe that's where we're headed?
I do believe that is where we're headed. And I said that the great fear I have is that we will eventually face tyranny in this country because of the breakdown of order and people therefore surrendering their liberties. And the breakdown of order would be hastened by a political regime that does not understand the necessity for moral base in society, that ignores it, or as a matter of fact, scorns it. Actually, one of the things that I find most troubling in American life today, and it's partially our fault as Christians, we have made a very good apologetic defense of why Christian truth is absolutely essential for the survival in society, and this is something we need to do a better job of. But people are actually resenting us. And so the one group in society that can bring that moral influence to bear is the group that is being the most resented. And so it becomes very politically attractive. I used to figure out where the votes were and where the numbers were and make political policies to reach the greatest number, because that's how you get elected. And if I were engineering it right now, I would distance myself from the religious right as soon as I got the nomination. And I would head smack for the center of the political spectrum and figure that's where the votes are, and with an unpopular president, you could scoop up the center, be an economic conservative and a social liberal, and win. And that's my nightmare, that that will happen.
Chuck, 52% of evangelical Christians, according to Barna Research, do not believe in absolute truth. Now, when you don't have absolute truth, when you don't have anything that you can say absolutely and with certainty that this is fact, now, that includes, of course, the divinity of Christ, the authenticity of the scriptures, and everything else. 52% don't believe in that. If you don't have that, all you've got left is what seems right is right, and you determine your values by public opinion poll and the will of the people. This generation, or some of this generation, remembers World War II, where the most horrible acts in history, perhaps, the Nazi Holocaust, seemed right to people then. You know, we've come out of the consequences of that that cost 50 million lives around the world by the time World War II was over. And yet here we are, four and a half decades later, or five decades later, saying we don't believe in absolute truth. We don't believe there is anything true, which means the will of the people, whatever seems right at any given time, is truth. The contradiction there never ceases to amaze me.
Well, it's cognitive dissonance. It's a disconnect. People are not drawing that connection in their own minds.
You know, several years ago, I thought about all these things you're talking about today, and flatly got depressed. And I stayed depressed for 2 or 3 months until I finally went before the Lord and I said, Lord, I'm not responsible for the moral tone of the whole nation, and yet I'm foolishly fallen into the trap of feeling like I am. You got to lift this from me. And he did. But the reason I got depressed is because of an awakening in my mind to an error in my thinking. I had believed that there were politicians and there were people who were doing wrong, wicked, evil things that the people didn't know about. And if I would tell them, they would react, you know, and they would say, we got to put a stop to this. And then I began to realize that an awful lot of them out there don't care, and that they know it and it doesn't matter. And that is reflected in some of the recent elections and the other things that are going on. Now, there's still an awful lot of people out there with strong spiritual convictions, but it feels to me like the majority is tipping over into that other camp that does not understand that moral foundation for everything the nation is.
Well, let me say this about despair, because sometimes I feel it, and I talked the other night to a small group of friends and talked about the crisis of truth and where it was leading us in our society. And one man, a younger man than I, most people are these days, he's 38, came up to me and said, you sound so despairing. There's got to be some hope. And I said, of course there is hope. I've read the last page of the Bible. Despair is a sin. But at the same time, we've got to realistically look at the state of our culture. And the state of our culture, this culture today is sick. And the critical question, which people are unable to answer, how then shall we live? You can't answer that when everybody says we're going to make our own rules. There have to be, and all through Western civilization, from the Greeks forward, there have been a set of transcendent values that people say, these are the standards we choose to live by. And we might differ from time to time on what they are, but we would say there are objective realities. There is such a thing called truth. The Greeks could talk about the virtues of courage and temperance and justice and prudence. And the Christians could talk about faith, hope, and charity, the virtues that were added to it. And through the years, these governed our behavior. These provided a basis for civic duty and civic responsibility, which our Republican founders well understood. That is being thrown over the side today by the media, which says, do whatever you please, in their advertising and in their editorial policies, and actually feeding us stuff that appeals to our base instincts instead of to virtue. 11% of the school teachers, I just saw Jim a study. I don't know the source of this. I've got to get it. But Peter Kreft at Boston College used it. 11% of the school teachers said that they would be willing or able to teach moral truths to their students. Only 11%. And so you look at that, and yeah, you get really discouraged. And yet, we got to sound the alarm. We got to be the watchman. We got to be the people that say, this is what is happening to our culture. But don't despair.
Yeah.
Despair is a sin.
It is. Gideon's torch does sound the alarm. That's your purpose, wasn't it?
I wrote that book to appeal to the imagination, because good stories, and I've thought back through my own life, literature has more impact than reasoning with people. And so I wrote it for that purpose, as an alarm, as a wake-up call to the
American
people.
Does it end with hope?
At the end, one of the Christian pastors who struggles all through it with how you deal with a government is murdered, I'll say that. And out of his murder comes the first sign of hope. It's hope in the sense that, yes, out of good will always overcome evil.
You refer to Romans 12 in the foreword to the book. Explain the context of that.
Well, the context is that ultimately the incarnation, that is, God becoming flesh in the person of Jesus, was the supreme example of good overcoming evil. And so the Apostle Paul, at the time when, if you remember, Christians were being used as human torches in Rome and being persecuted and thrown in jail and prison, the Apostle Paul said, we must overcome evil with good. And I understand the pro-life movement feeling that it's been driven to the margins, that it can't make any political changes, that all doors have been closed to it, and they virtually have been. And so people on the extremes are saying, we better go out and kill abortionists. And one of the messages of this book is, no, you don't go out and kill abortionists. You still overcome evil by good. And I use in the foreword of the book and in the dedication of the book, Jerzy Papalusko, the Polish priest who preached overcome evil by good, defend the truth. Hundreds of thousands came out. Eventually the communists murdered him. And after they murdered him, he had taught the people well, because they marched through the streets, not in revolution, but with banners which said, we forgive, we forgive, we forgive. And 3 years later, that monstrous system called communism collapsed of its own weight. So the overriding message of Gideon's Torch is right out of Romans 12, which is overcome evil with good.
You know, that reference to the communist system does give us hope, because in 1981, 82, 83, no one suspected that that entire system was in its death throes. No one fully realized, or at least the media didn't recognize, that the whole thing was collapsing, and it didn't look like it. I mean, that probably the most powerful military on earth, and they had influence around the world, and yet it's gone. Mm-hmm. Maybe we're in better shape than we think we are. Maybe there are people out there who are concerned about what we're concerned about, Chuck, and maybe a turnaround is coming.
Well, don't forget that, you know, the people that come to us today and say, oh, I'm scared of Christians getting in politics. I'm scared of the new right. I'm scared of this religious movement. I'll always say to them, why? And they'll say, because you worship a higher king. You don't simply obey the rules of the state. You believe there's a king above the state. You believe that you have God's word that is more powerful than the state's word. And I say, yeah, that's exactly right. And you ought to be glad I do, because if you look at the fall of Eastern Europe, the fall of communism, you will see that every single one of those martyrs, oddly enough, had a reverend before his name. Why? Because he worshipped a king above the tyrants of this earth. That's why the Christian has always been a scandal to every tyrant, every pretender to power. That's why the Jew has been a scandal. And thank God for us. Yeah. I've had many of my neighbors say, yeah, gee, put it that way, I guess you're right. We're your best friend because we protect you against tyranny. And that's, again, one of the messages of this book.
One of the frustrating comments that I hear that makes me want to gnash my teeth is that everybody is entitled to work within the system to effect change according to their beliefs. That's given to us by the Constitution. And when those on the left do that, they're just exercising their right. Homosexual activists and others, they have a right to do what they're doing. But when Christians do it, they're trying to shove their ideas down everybody else's throats.
Yeah, well, that's a double standard, but we all have to live with them. We might as well recognize it. Fortunately, the people react against it.
It does show the bias. Gideon's Torch, a novel by Charles Colson and Ellen Vaughn. You want to give some credit to your...
Ellen Vaughn has been a great colleague of mine over the last 15 years when I hired her right out of school at Georgetown, and we've been working together on projects ever since, and she's become a really accomplished writer, and we had a lot of fun writing this together. And I just want to say one thing: of all the books I've written, this is the one that I hope doesn't come true.
Chuck, it's always good to have you here. I appreciate your insights. You are maybe the only minister in the country who has seen both sides of this thing from inside the White House and now from the perspective of in full-time Christian service. And that gives you a very unique point of view that I just happen to agree with.
So well, we find ourselves on the same side on what is the overriding moral issue of the day. The overriding moral issue of the day, and the first of all the moral issues on which a society must agree with, and the first that our founders did when they enunciated those unforgettable words that are the covenant of this nation, the Declaration of Independence, the right to life. And if we sacrifice that, every other right thereafter is in jeopardy.
They all fall.
They all fall. That's the domino.
Thank you, Chuck, for being
with
us.
Thank you, Jim.
You've been listening to part one of a classic program titled The Future of America here on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. I'm Ryan Dobson, and if you'd like more information about this program or the Ministry of Family Talk, you can call us at 877-732-6825 or visit our website at drjamesdobson.org. And in listening to today's program, I couldn't help but think about my dad's fiction trilogy, including the books Fatherless, Childless, and the soon-to-be-released conclusion titled Godless. Chuck Colson and my dad talked about so many issues facing America, and this trilogy dives into many of those issues in an entertaining yet compelling way. What happens when the world exchanges the truth of God for a lie? What happens when kids grow up in fatherless homes or couples decide to stop having children altogether? This trilogy deals with all of those issues along with many others. And right now you can pick up one or all of these books when you call us or visit our website. For a suggested donation of $25 or more, we'll send you Godless, the highly anticipated conclusion of the trilogy. And for $75 or more, we'll send you the entire trilogy, including Fatherless, Childless, and godless. So call Family Talk today at 877-732-6825 or visit our website at drjamesdobson.org. God bless, and we'll see you next time for more with Chuck Colson right here on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk.
Family Talk is not affiliated with Focus on the Family.
Hello, everyone. I'm James Dobson. For those of you who enjoy our radio program, Family Talk, I have some good news. When you're not able to hear Family Talk on your favorite Christian radio station, you can catch us by downloading the new Family Talk mobile app. You can not only use the app to hear our broadcast 24 hours a day, but you can view video commentaries or get answers to your family-related questions with our Solid Answers tool. They're all free and available on Android, iPhone, and iPad devices. I hope you'll visit your app marketplace to download it today. And thanks for listening to Family Talk.